This is Live and Local. It's your local performance connection, and today's program will be devoted to conversations about the concert this coming Sunday night by the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra, opening their academic season. It starts at 7:30 Sunday at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, although the whole evening's events start at 6:30, and because for the first time they're going to be having a pre-concert lecturer, guest pre-concert lecturer, presenting at 6:30, and I'll be talking with him at some length in the later portion of the show. Alan Schwab is his name. First up, though, will be the graduate assistant conductor for the UI Symphony, Aaron Kaplan, who put me on to Professor Schwab, and we'll be talking a little bit about the first part of that concert, which opens with the overture to the operetta Die Fledermaus, or The Bat, by Johann Strauss Jr. And that music may well be familiar to you. It's certainly one of Strauss's better-known works, of that of many that are quite well-known, the overture to his operetta Die Fledermaus, which is German for The Bat. And you'd have to know the story to know why it's called The Bat. And the performance given by the orchestra of the Vienna Volksoper, led by Franz Bauer-Teussel here on Live and Local. You can hear that performance, that entire piece, played by the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra to open its concert Sunday night at the Krannert Center. It starts at 7:30 with a pre-concert lecture at 6:30, and I'll be talking with the lecturer later on in the program. But first up, the University of Illinois has a graduate assistant conductor. His name is Aaron Kaplan, and this is his first year in the master's degree program. Of course, the orchestra overall conducted by Professor Donald Schleicher, with whom Aaron, you are studying, and I understand that was probably the biggest appeal on deciding to do the program here.
Yeah, absolutely. Professor Schleicher is a wonderful teacher and a conductor, and it was one of the biggest draws to continuing my education here after graduating with a bachelor's degree in the spring.
In cello performance?
Mm-hmm. In music ed, yeah.
Oh, in music ed?
Yep.
Okay, but concentrating in cello
mm-hmm.
in particular, and studying with
Brandon Vamos.
Brandon Vamos of the Pacifica Quartet. There are two cello professors here, Dmitry Kuzov, the other one. And what is the role of a graduate assistant with the orchestra?
Well, my role is the manager of the orchestra. So I help out with auditions at the beginning of the year, and then I keep the email roster. I also pass out the music and keep track of attendance and make sure that all the logistics for the symphony are taken care of, from the day-to-day rehearsals up to the concert, and making sure all the chairs and stands are set up and the program is correct, and just all managerial work with the orchestra.
Do you have to do any of the library work, meaning working with the instrumental parts and so on?
Mm-hmm. I'm in charge of the orchestra and the choral collection at the school, so that's actually not part of the assistantship. That's an hourly position, but it works because it takes away the middleman. So whenever I need new music for the orchestra, I just hop on over to the library and check in the parts catalog and distribute them.
And so you can just assign them to yourself.
Right.
Check them out to yourself,
exactly.
Which is, yeah, pretty convenient. Do you have to deal at all with orchestral bowings, or how does that work with the orchestra?
Usually, we'll leave the bowings up to the principals and the concertmaster, and usually they will bow their part. They'll get together and they'll bow their parts, and either we'll make a copy of the parts and distribute it to the rest of the section, or depending on how many bowings there are, they'll tell them in rehearsal. But sometimes I have a wonderful staff of three who help set up, and sometimes the four of us will get together on a Saturday and bow a Brahms symphony, for example, if there's a significant amount of bowings. So sometimes we do the bowings.
And for those who don't know what we're even talking about by bowings, that basically means that you determine how the strings string sections or the individual string sections, when they will play with the down bow, stroking the bow downwards, when they will do it up bow, and it matters. Well, why does it matter?
Well, it can matter for a lot of different reasons. Certain articulations, if there's a certain articulation that's printed in the music, sometimes it'll work better on a string instrument if it's a down or an up bow. Sometimes the conductor or the concertmaster or the principals will, of the principals, meaning the first chair of the of each string section, they'll want a specific bowing a certain way because perhaps the phrase indicates, so the musical line indicates so, and then again the articulation, and sometimes we all want the bowings to match within the whole string section. So there are a lot of different reasons why we take care of bowing so detailedly.
Well, and one of them is frankly aesthetic, because it looks cool to have all of the violins doing the same thing at the same time.
Yes.
Although there are occasions when a conductor might want what's called free bowing, where everybody will do their own thing because it can create a different sort of sound.
Right. Different sort of sounds, and especially different colors can happen with different bowings also.
So do you have any role in selecting the music for a given concert, or does Professor Schleicher talk to you about how he chooses programs?
Well, none of us really have a role in choosing the repertoire. Sometimes at the end of the year, he will ask not only the grad students but the orchestra members if they have any suggestions of a piece that they've always wanted to play. But the repertoire is set the summer before the previous year. When I started working in the office for the assistantship in the summer, the repertoire for the entire year, September through May, was already set. And he picks the programming based on and his educational philosophy, which is that he wants everyone in the orchestra to play a good amount of standard repertoire. So we have a lot of standard pieces. This first concert, I'd say all three pieces are considered in the standard repertoire. And then in that, there's programming choices that go with the three concerto winners of our concerto competition. And we also have a composition competition, which that new music piece usually comes up in the spring. And then between those staples, we kind of fill in the program with timing constraints and other things.
And then I assume that every once in a while he throws in something that's not standard that he thinks is worth the orchestra's spending time on, and the experience of learning something new.
Yes, absolutely.
Although I imagine to most students, much of it is new, whether it's standard or not, since they're just on the cusp of their careers, they hope.
Yeah.
Well, here's a little bit from the other piece that's on the program that we haven't mentioned so far. Of course, it starts with the Fledermaus Overture, ends with the First Symphony of Brahms, and includes Stravinsky's ballet Petrushka. Is he doing the full ballet score?
The full ballet score, the revised 1947 edition, which is a little bit longer than the 1911 edition. But the ballet suite runs about 35 minutes, and we're doing the whole thing.
And there are four. It's organized into four tableaus. Correct. For the sake of the visual story, and this is the beginning of the fourth one, which is known as the Shrovetide Fair. This is a performance by the Montreal Symphony Orchestra conducted by Charles Dutoit. So that's just a really tiny fragment of Stravinsky's ballet Petrushka. It's a wonderful score, and that comes from the final tableau performance here. Charles Dutoit conducting the Montreal Symphony Orchestra. You can hear the complete work played by the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra Sunday evening, starting at 7:30. Aaron Kaplan is my guest. He's Maestro Donald Schleicher's graduate assistant for the orchestra, orchestra manager, and taking on a little bit of a role of publicity chair, it seems, which is how I got to know of the guest we'll be talking with next on the show, who is Alan Schwab, who's on the faculty at American Studies faculty at Washington University in St. Louis as a pre-concert lecturer for the St. Louis Symphony quite often, and is going to be doing those honors for the UI concert starting at 6:30 on Sunday night. Have you had a chance to do any conducting of the pieces that are on the program? I mean, either in the course of rehearsals or in any time in the past?
I've actually worked with all three pieces at various times in the past couple of years, never in rehearsal or performance with the UI Symphony, but in my one of my beginning conducting classes, we did excerpts from the Deflator Mouse Overture. And the first time that I conducted in Professor Schleicher's seminar as an undergrad was on the Brahms First Symphony with our lab string orchestra and our two pianos covering the winds and brass parts. And then a lot of his students, we went to a conducting workshop with him two summers ago in the Czech Republic, and we all studied Petrushka because that was one of the pieces on the rep list. So I've had minimal experience with all three pieces, but in various capacities and with different groups.
And very different types of music. This Fledermaust Overture has a lot of challenges,
yeah,
doesn't it?
It's I think the hardest, there's one hard thing about for each piece, and it's different. With Fledermaus, it's definitely getting into the style, the Viennese waltz style, and lots of transitions and tempo changes, as is traditional with an overture. And then the Stravinsky is very technically demanding. It's a very difficult piece for all the players involved, a very exposed piano part as well. And then the Brahms is it's a gargantuan work. It's taxing. It's 45 minutes. It's a long symphony, and musically it's very difficult to make sure we get all of Brahms's nuance that he put into the score. And so it's a great concert to start off the year with because it tackles three really big issues.
Both for conductors who are studying it and yes, especially for the orchestra to play it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's a great program, Fledermaus and Petrushka and Brahms' First Symphony, Sunday night at 7:30. Aaron, thanks for letting me know about Professor Schwab. We'll be talking to you in a couple of minutes, and thanks for coming in yourself.
Thank you.
It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. Our program is made possible with support from Outback Concerts, presenting Australian guitarist and CMA Global Country Artist Award winner Tommy Emmanuel at the Virginia Theater on September 21st, which is Wednesday. Tickets are on sale now at thevirginia.org. Charge by phone 217-356-9063.
The signal power of our sister station, AM 580, will be further reduced this week, conditions permitting, and the next phase of our tower repair will begin. You may be unable to hear AM 580 for as long as 2 weeks. The program service on FM 90.9 will not be affected. You can hear AM 580 online at will.illinois.edu. Thank you for your patience as we work to bring you a much improved AM 580 signal.
We just heard the very opening movement from the First Symphony of Johannes Brahms. That will be the third piece on the program Sunday night by the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra, Don Schleicher conducting. And we heard a bit from Aaron Kaplan earlier. And my next guest is a fellow who does what he's going to do for the UI Symphony with some regularity for the St. Louis Symphony, that is, give a pre-concert talk. And as far as we know, this is the first time anybody's really done this for the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra, so I don't know if this is planned to be a trend. But with me on the phone is Alan Schwab, who will be giving that pre-concert lecture. He's on the faculty at Washington University in St. Louis. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
And what part of the faculty are you on?
I teach in the American Culture Studies program. I'm particularly interested in the interrelationship of the arts, and especially the beginnings of American cultural history through the Civil War.
And so how did you get started on the whole business of pre-concert lecturing? I think some of these lectures, for lack of a better term, as you've described them to me anyway, get rather elaborate.
Well, I had been writing program notes for the for Colgate University in upstate New York, where I worked after I completed doctoral work. And when my family and I moved to the Metro St. Louis area, I went to the St. Louis Symphony and I asked them if they had an educational outreach program. And the executive director of the symphony had just come from Oregon, and he said, "It's interesting that you ask, because in Portland, we have a pre-concert lecture in front of every single performance of the orchestra. Here in St. Louis, they're only done once a week on Sundays, and so I'm looking for people to help me in having them in front of every concert that the St. Louis Symphony does." And so he hired me, and I started doing that, and that was nearly 30 years ago, and over 100 of these free multimedia pre-concert lectures. And there's a kind of stable of people who do this, all with different approaches to the work that are being performed. And mine is one of cultural history. I'm not a performing musician. I don't even sing in the shower anymore, since my wife and child threatened to leave me if I didn't stop doing that. So I'm interested in how the cultural pieces fit together, and it dovetails with my academic work, and it's been a great joy to do this for a very long time in Powell Hall.
So this is, you actually anticipated a question I was going to ask, which is about the performing musician aspect. This is just something you've come by as an appreciative listener over many years, I guess.
That's right, and one of collecting music and of listening to, having grown up in Chicago, I learned a great deal of music from WFMT in the Fine Arts Station in Chicago. And I was an undergraduate at Urbana and listened to WILL every night and expanded my repertoire by listening to the concerts at during the dinner hour.
So when you say collecting music, you mean collecting recorded music?
Yes.
Do you have favorite periods of music?
Yes. By and large, the Romantics and the post-Romantics. I've gotten very interested in the work of Gustav Mahler. I gave a couple of lectures, illustrated lectures, this past year, because, as you know, the 10-11 season was both the sesquicentennial of Mahler's birth and the centennial of Mahler's death. So orchestras all over the world were spending time and giving attention to the works of Mahler. And it was a particularly good year to focus on him.
Yeah, good year for Mahlerians to go.
You bet.
To go listen. So if you're particularly into the Romantics and post-Romantics, then Johannes Brahms should fit squarely in the middle of that.
He really does. And there's such an interesting story connected with the construction and the creation of this symphony, that it's one of my favorite works to talk about. As most people know who are fond of the symphony and collect recordings of it and read program notes, they know that this took Brahms a very long time, over 20 years to write this. And it is a wonderful story about high expectations and lower self-esteem over the years. The story, of course, is that his mentor, the famous pianist and composer Robert Schumann, wrote a very effusive review a comment about Brahms in 1853, when Brahms was only 20 and had written nothing more important than a few piano scores and songs. And he had very, very enthusiastic praise about Brahms, saying that he was going to be a great artist. And many young composers, many young artists in any media, would kill for that kind of press and recognition. Brahms was shy and self-effacing and really was appalled at the kinds of expectations that Schumann had laid on him. And as a result, spent a very long time worrying about writing a symphony. And even though it was from Schumann and other friends expected of him, he worried about what the reception was going to be. So we know he had made sketches for this symphony as early as 1854, and it wasn't performed until 1876, even though he had sent fragments of the completed score to friends. And there's an old story that as early as the late 1860s, the early 1870s, Brahms was carrying around in his coat pocket a completed score of the whole symphony, but would not show it to any conductors or any orchestras because he didn't feel he was ready. He was 43 years old at the time of the premiere, even though that great notice from Robert Schumann had appeared when he was 20.
So when you say it took him 20 years to write it, that sounds like it's only partly the actual writing of it, and the other part is just getting up the guts to have it released.
That's right. He was. That's exactly right. I think probably the best guess is that he may have tinkered with the score for the better part of 10 years, and the rest of the time was reluctance and worry about what people were going to say, and then of course when the actual premiere took place, he was no more fortunate with the reception because of this, as we look at it with 2020 cultural perspective, there was this silly kind of feud going on between two warring camps in Central Europe. One was the Wagnerians, the people who championed the work of Wagner, and before him of Liszt and Berlioz and von Weber, romantics, in other words, who gloried in breaking boundaries, in freedom, in smashing up, in other words, as Beethoven had done, the conventional symphonic form. And there were the more conservative, camp, the Brahmsians, in other words, who seized on the very neoclassic architecture of the C minor symphony to say this is the way, this is the future. In other words, an emphasis on form and content and balance rather than on breaking the boundaries. So it was only many years later, when this kind of silly feud died out, that the Brahms First Symphony was recognized as the very, very great accomplishment that it is. And today, I think it's probably fair to say there is no more frequently performed work symphony in the basic repertoire.
And then he went on to write three more. Did they have? Did they follow in quick succession, or did he take a long time to do each of those?
No. That's interesting. The Brahms felt so good about the completion of the first symphony that within a year, he had done the second, and several years after that, he had done the third. The fourth, there was a little bit of a delay. Premiered near the very end of Brahms's life, but the first three symphonies clustered together in very rapid order. So clearly, the reception, the critical and the public reception of the first symphony, was a confidence boost, and was a reassurance to Brahms that people understand what I'm doing and appreciate it.
So enough people did appreciate it that this feud didn't discourage him.
That's, I think, a fair assessment. There were critics of the First Symphony who found it cold and forbidding and not reflecting, in other words, sufficient romantic warmth for them. Hugo Wolf, the turn-of-the-century composer, and especially Philip Hale, who wrote program notes for many years and was a journalist in Boston. He was the program annotator for the Boston Symphony. Philip Hale absolutely loathed the work and wrote scathing comments about it as being cold and distant and forbidding, even morbid. And we just have a hard time understanding this as we hear it today. It seems songful. It certainly seems stern, but a work of great lyricism, of great drama, and of great audience appeal.
I'm actually looking at a quote you kindly sent me, kind of a preview of your talk, and Philip Hale says here, "I'm willing to admit without argument that the symphony is grand and impressive and all that, but so is a channel fog." Hope I didn't steal your thunder there, but no, I found that particularly amusing.
and there were other contemporaries of Brahms who felt the same way. I'm going to be quoting some excerpts from Peter Tchaikovsky, who was an exact contemporary of Brahms, and who had absolutely no use for him. He felt that Brahms was a kind of pale imitation of Beethoven, and that without the, in other words, attempting Beethoven-style architecture without having Beethoven-style musical gifts. And that was the one of the particular difficulties that Tchaikovsky had with Brahms. So it's I guess important to know, Brahms was a polarizing figure in his own lifetime. We don't regard him that way. We have taken Brahms to our heart as a figure of great romantic warmth and affection. And most of us sing along with Brahms as we hear his scores. But that was not the way everybody responded to him in his own lifetime.
One of the neat things about choosing to either talk about or just generally appreciate music of that era, from the historical perspective, is that you can go out and you can go back and read some of the music critics, who overall were much more colorful and mean than contemporary music critics. So it can be fun just to read music criticism from back.
There's a wonderful book by Nicholas Lanemsky of a couple of centuries of musical invective. The kind of insults, in other words, which have been directed at some very great composers, and some of it, of course, is fun to read. Some of it is very entertaining, and some of it is very surprising. And such as the thing from the quote from Philip Hale. But that's, I think, one of the values of pre-concert lectures in general, and that is there's a reason why virtually every major orchestra in America and many of the smaller ones have done this. It wasn't so common when I started in the 80s with the St. Louis Symphony, but it's certainly very common now. And one of the reasons is to help people be more informed listeners, to help them look and notice some things that they might otherwise miss, so that they can think about what they're hearing and then take that information home, perhaps, when they play it in their living rooms, and think about, oh, yes, I recognize this. This is something I heard about when I went to Concert X or Recital Y. So it's been an effort on the part of orchestras, in other words, to give their audiences more bang for the buck, more an extra kind of bonus.
Well, here's a little bit of a bonus. I mean, not really a bonus to play music on a combination talk music program, but I do want to play a little bit of the Brahms Symphony, even just to give by way of brief illustration. The second movement, you told me, has something special about it that doesn't appear in other symphonies. You want to talk about that a little bit before we hear it?
The second movement, the Andante, a fairly brief movement after the upheavals and the drama and the strife of the first movement, has a solo violin and a very attractive melodic interlude in effect, and it's the only time in all of Brahms's four symphonies where there is a solo violin, and it makes a memorable kind of impact.
And a tune you can go out and sing if you want.
You sure can.
This is from the second movement of Johannes Brahms' First Symphony, which will be played by the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra Sunday night at the Krannert Center in Urbana. And I'm talking with Alan Schwab from the Washington University faculty, who's going to be giving the pre-concert lecture in advance of that program. And I think it starts at 6:30, doesn't it?
It does, 6:30 in the orchestra rehearsal room on the second level of Krannert.
And here's Johannes Brahms on Live and Local. We heard a little bit of the second movement of Johannes Brahms' First Symphony, which features the solo violin that Alan Schwab pointed out to us. And we'll be pointing out not only that spot, but a great many other moments in the Brahms First as he delivers his pre-concert lecture Sunday night before the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra plays that piece, and also music by Johann Strauss Jr. and Igor Stravinsky. So you'll have to go to the talk to hear really a very nicely detailed description along with musical excerpts to enhance your enjoyment of that piece. One of the things, Alan, that you comment on in your lecture is the fact that the two outside movements are unique in his own symphonies, that they have introductions where one of the characteristic things about so many other Brahms pieces, including those other symphonies, is that they just start
right,
seemingly out of nowhere.
Right.
Does that have anything to do with the what you refer to as the neoclassical structure?
I do. I think that's exactly what it is. That we know, for example, that the he had sent the score of the first movement to Clara Schumann, to Robert Schumann's widow, and it didn't contain an introduction. It just started with the it just starts without that 37-bar introduction, and so it was clearly something that he added later. We don't know whether he did the same thing with the fourth movement, but the fact remains, it's there for purposes of structure, and of balance, and the I think, as Brahms obviously grew more comfortable with symphonic form, it may well have been something that he said, I don't need the scaffolding to stay up after I erect the building. The introduction, in other words, was a part of the construction, and the scaffolding may not be so necessary. Fact remains, it works beautifully in the first and fourth movements of the first symphony, and Brahms was probably correct that he didn't need it realization of the symphonies that followed.
You know, as a conductor, I should probably know the answer to this from meticulous analysis, but I can't say that I've ever really figured it out or tried. But what makes Brahms's orchestral music sound the way it does? Because it seems to me it sounds like nobody else's music.
I think you're exactly right. There's a kind of rich, deep sound that Brahms has. A heavy emphasis, in other words, on lower strings, on cellos and double basses. Brahms was very fond of the clarinet, for example. At the very end of his life, he was writing a clarinet, the chamber music, featuring the clarinet. It is something that the way in which horns and French horns, cellos, clarinets provide a kind of plush, dark, rich sound, which seems to have dovetailed very well for the kind of inner music, what Brahms must have heard, in other words, in between his ears, as he was writing, something that is long lined, something that provides great rhythmic strength, in other words, but is songful and is lyric. It's what happens, in other words, what seems clear is that as a composer matures, the message, the sound message, gets clearer and gets easier to express. And as he or she crystallizes, in other words, what's comfortable kinds of musical speech. And that seems to be that characteristically rich, dark sound is what we, I think, often think of as characteristically Brahmsian. It's not just in the symphonies. The concerti also have it, especially the second piano concerto, the double concerto for violin and cello, are very much characteristic of the same kind of impulse.
And also characteristic, I think, especially of the orchestral music, can be a lot of, I don't want to say emotional distress, but a certain amount of emotional turmoil sometimes that seems to be there in Brahms. And right at the end of the piece, that all seems to go away, just as the final tune comes in. I know every time I listen to it, I mean, I enjoy the beginning of the last movement, but it does have a certain amount of turmoil. And then all of a sudden, it's like the sun shines through and you have this marvelous, almost chorale tune.
You're an astute listener. I think there's the strongest sense, in other words, of triumph, of overcoming, of affirmation, of having dealt with a struggle and having emerged victorious. I don't know how else one can listen to the kind of that final presto of the speed to the conclusion of the symphony without thinking, I've been through a struggle, I've listened to a struggle, and I know who came out on top in this kind of arrangement. That's why as a kind of finale, you don't program, in other words, the Brahms First Symphony in the first half of a concert.
No, you wouldn't.
That sends people out of the house happy and with a sense of this has been a special night to do it. And I would be remiss without saying a word about Maestro Schleicher and the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra. I'm an alum, and it was only when I had the chance to move a little closer to Champaign-Urbana that my wife and I had the opportunity to come back and visit and hear the orchestra, and we were dumbfounded. I remember what the University of Illinois Symphony Orchestra sounded like in the 60s when it was playing in the auditorium. To come back in the first time I remember doing this was in 2003, and to hear the level of professionalism, to hear the way in which the orchestra responds to Donald Schleicher, in other words, to have an illustration of understanding the difference between playing the notes and playing the music, is something that, in my view, who has knocked around professional orchestras a fair number of years, is just a remarkable kind of accomplishment, which may well be taken for granted for people who live in Champaign-Urbana and can sample it regularly. For those of us who may live a couple of hundred miles away and have to make a special trip to hear it, it's easier to appreciate what a special accomplishment Donald Schleicher and the orchestra have, what partners they make. It's to me remarkable, and I look forward to their concerts regularly.
Well, it is a fabulous organization, and they do a terrific job uniformly, I think, whenever I've heard them. And folks can enjoy hearing your pre-concert talk. It starts at 6:30 Sunday before the U of I Symphony Orchestra concert. The concert starts at 7:30. Talk starts at 6:30. And you'll be focusing on the Symphony of Brahms, but the program also includes the Fledermaus Overture of Strauss, Johann Strauss Jr., and the Ballet Petrushka by Stravinsky. Don Schleicher conducting, and it's at the Kranitz Center for the Performing Arts on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana. Alan Schwab.
Going to be a special night.
Yeah. Alan Schwab has been my guest. Thanks very much for joining us on the show.
Thank you, Kevin, for your invitation.
And here is that final joyous movement, segment of the final movement of the First Symphony of Johannes Brahms here on Live and Local.